Welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. I'm Kate Carruthers, and today my guest is Gerard Solden. Now, I recorded this a while back, and I do apologize for the gap in episodes, but I got a bit busy in my personal life, so sorry about that. Gerard is a really interesting character. He has started his career in high-level quantitative analysis in finance, and he's worked for many major banks internationally and in Australia. And he's worked on solving complex quantitative problems. And now he is working in advanced AI infrastructure to support AI. So it's a pretty natural growth from a statistical world to the AI world. And his personal interest is focused mainly on model inference, sparsity, quantization, and hardware inference design. And he's really interested in embedding tech and large AI system infrastructure design. He's really about building the core infrastructure of AI. So I know there's a lot of hype about AI and a lot of people saying that AI is not real. The technology is real, and there are people working on this seriously, and Gerard's one of them. So enjoy. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. Today, my guest is Gerard Solden. Welcome, Gerard.
Nice to meet you all. And thanks, Kate. Really appreciate being on your show.
Looking forward to our chat. Why don't you give a bit of an introduction to yourself?
Okay, great. Look, my name's Gerard. I am from Australia. I was formerly working at the major tier one banking institutions, you know, such as Westpac and CBA. Before that at hedge funds and Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank in London. And I was always around the quantitative space. And more as of recently, I was actually heading up the quantitative solutioning group over at Westpac for the last 3 years. And I was involved with another quantitative solutioning group over at CBA for 5 years before that. So it's been an amazing journey to get to AI. I look forward to being able to discuss some of these things with you.
Well, it's a good day to be another refugee from banking, I reckon.
It certainly is, given how today's been in the sector. So thank goodness we're talking about AI today.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I'm always hearing is people saying, oh, AI is a big scam. It's a huge Ponzi scheme. It's all rubbish. And I keep saying, no, there's real technology under here and it is going to change the world. There is a Ponzi element, and as there always is when there's a new big thing. But what are you working on that you're seeing the reality of this stuff, and how is it changing business?
Yeah, look, that's a great point that you made. And we find that a lot of that comes from the fact that a lot of our customers, when we speak to them, they actually have very few little understanding about their use cases and about how to apply AI to their business in ways that make sense, that are methodical, and that they can get accurate and good results. And so as a consequence of that, we've actually built out a number of different solutions to try and ensure that we have a lot more accuracy than our peers. And so what we're really focusing on is accuracy, efficiency, and performance to be able to ensure that our enterprise customers have something that, to your point, seems a lot less like a Ponzi scheme, but something that is truly helpful and something that can be measured.
And I think that's touching on a really important thing. One of the things I was talking to my students about last week at my sort of introductory AI course is the difference between generative AI, which is largely probabilistic, and our traditional systems are more deterministic. So we can rely upon answers from them. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we need to be able to build in AI is reliable and consistent answers, not probabilistic, not probably right, really right.
Well, one of the beautiful things about the agentic frameworks right now is the ability to be able to assess that probability over multiple iterations, so that what you can do is ostensibly hone your answers towards something more correct right now. Imagine on your first layer that you give a response and that's incorrect. Mm-hmm. But it just so happens that in a standard throughput, that's what would be given to a regular user. In an agentic pipeline, you have the ability to get different kinds of models to be able to review the previous iterations to be able to understand whether it's correct or not. And so that's
hold on a sec.
Sure.
We probably need to, because we've leapt into talking about agentic without explaining it to the audience. So I think everybody's familiar with what we're talking about when we talk about generative AI now. But yeah. Can you explain agentic? Because I literally had my entire class go, what is this? And were like wanting to do deep dives into it once they found out what it was. So.
Okay, absolutely. So from what we understood, and as we've seen agentic pipelines evolve over the last 2 years, initially the agentic pipelines as they were defined was the ability for a model to be able to use external tools and be able to use that in the context of its own reasoning to be able to fashion something that was better than what came before. As a function of time and with a lot better processing, agentic pipelines have come to mean something more along the lines of a hive mind, i.e. the ability to be able to have multiple processing units in parallel or concurrent to each other to be able to process information both in parallel as well as sequentially to be able to form reasoning as a human would. So, for example, that you set up a task list, you can then assign that to different sub-agents. They can process a task that can be reviewed. And so what we're talking to is a more intricate pipeline of reasoning.
And it really can almost take over robotic process automation and run processes, which is, I think, the really interesting innovation from a business context, is that marrying up of being able to be more reasoned mm-hmm. and run processes unsupervised.
Completely. And so we're really seeing a big splay right now with regards to how the latest technology is actually being formulated. For example, we suspect that a lot of the technology of AI, of OpenAI and Anthropic, is actually some of their previous models with what we would call an agentic framework, this ability to be able to instantiate multiple models, have them talk to each other, and then be able to reason to get to a better understanding. We find that in this space, it's actually really interesting because there are some models that are trained, like DeepSeek's R1, to be able to be inherently reasoning. And yet there are external stacks that you can use to which can synthesize reasoning. And we're actually testing the performance between these two and seeing what actually yields better results. And the results are a little bit different than we were expecting.
Please tell me how. I'm really interested.
Yeah, look, I mean, we found that when we were able to merge tools into the reasoning models of the current state, like DeepSeek, that they were able to be leveraged a little bit better and more fluently on the fly than under an agentic stack. But to do something purposefully that was a lot longer in context, we found that we could reach an almost unlimited context with an agentic pipeline, because you could create sub-agents which would then be able to work on small pieces and then fashion them together, a bit like a quilt. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, have you had a play with Manus AI?
We have had a look at Manus AI, and we also looked at Grok 3's deep research. So Manus is fantastic in the respect that we were working on pretty much all the functionality except for the GUI that they have that shows the user interaction on the desktop, which we think is really, really cool. And it's something that we're looking into right now. Manus really confused a lot of people. So, Kate, I think to your point, I think there's a group called, I think they're called Monica, and they came out with Manus, Monica AI. And Manus, just for everyone in the audience, it is this phenomenally good agentic framework that sits on top of some of the most recent models coming out of China, and it performs amazingly well. We came to the conclusion that it's between semi-automation and full automation from what we can
get. Just for the benefit of the audience, it's still in closed beta. I've been trying to get it access for ages, and I finally got access the day before yesterday, so I've only had a bit of a poke around yesterday.
Oh, you should definitely try and get your audience to have a look as well at some point. It's really something special.
Yeah,
We see that as being foundationally what the future does look like. particularly with regards to workflow processing, the ability to be able to take loose and unscripted prompting to be able to do something quite meaningful with.
And that's one of the really interesting things with both the Chinese models, the DeepSeek and Manus, is, and I talked to one of my previous guests about this, at the moment we have to craft ourselves to prompt AI to give us decent results. And I think these need less of us shaping ourselves into weird forms to be able to get good outputs. And that's really interesting. And I wonder if that is actually a result of the US pressure on China over chips, over microchips.
That's a fantastic point. And I guess, wow, there's just so much to cover in this space, but let's try and keep it brief. Obviously, the US has gone a very different direction. So bigger is better. High technology, having access to the best possible tools at all times. With regards to the Chinese technology, it's something that our organization can understand a tiny bit more, because a lot of their innovation came from having access to a lot less technology and a lot less chips and a lot more innovation to be able to run things smaller, more efficiently, and to be able to bootstrap things that, you know, very useful aspects that we could build on top of what was coming out. So it's really something to be able to see that the US is under a little bit of pressure, particularly because if you're starting to equate 95 to 98% of the quality of some of the closed source providers that are spending huge amounts of money, and you're able to provide that for free, it does provide a very compelling argument for people as to why they should move or should.
Oh my God, yes. But the thing that I keep pointing out to people is, like, OpenAI, they took $9 billion just before Christmas. They spent it before it landed. They spend something like $2.50 to make a buck. Yeah. It's not sustainable. They're looking for another round now. And I really kind of predict that the future will be smaller, more custom bespoke models for specific things rather than one universal model to do all of the things for everybody.
Kate, you're talking about the cutting edge, and thank you so much for getting there. And, you know, I feel like you're leading me on a little bit to talk about
this. We
didn't
even plan this.
I hear you, but this is fantastic. You couldn't have crafted any better. From our standpoint, going back to the agentic reasoning, with agentic reasoning, you have the ability to specify different models for different tasks for different personalities. And what that means is that, to your point, Kate, is that if you were able to be able to distill what you required from both a science perspective, from an English perspective, from a mathematical perspective, from an artistic perspective, and distill them into smaller models and had them operate in conjunction with each other, we believe something like that looks more like the future. Mm. We don't think one large model that's able to do everything is even what you'd really want because of the kind of specialization that we've seen. So absolutely, Kate, the future that you're talking about is something that we're trying to build right now.
I'm excited about this future. And, you know, one of the things that I've been talking about since early last year, where I could already see that on our phones we would end up with our own, you know, custom models here that are personal and private to us that know us and know where we are, who we're with, what we're doing, and can provide us with much more personalized, customized things. From a consumer perspective, that seems to be what they want. All I want is a calendaring assistant. I need
a
calendar.
Phone call.
I need a calendaring assistant. It's the hardest thing. That's why executive assistants get so much money, because they're miracle workers.
Arranging people's days. I hear thee. It's some of our problems as well. My guys work, you know, 22 hours a day in some instances. So keeping an idea of calendars is also a good idea when you work those kinds of hours.
Yeah. So what are your folks working on?
Okay, so look, from our standpoint, my company is called Multiverse Partners. We're 2 years old. We have been operating since the inflection point of GPT-3, and our mission was to be able to provide the benefits of AI without the drawbacks from a security standpoint that we were seeing in cloud-based solutions. So our solutions are all based on being on-premise, whether that is on-premise for a large-scale organization in their data center, or whether that's a small SME and we have a small portable device that we released to the market last year that's able to provide for 100 users concurrently.
It's really good. You're making me feel good because I predicted this. I predict this in 2023 where when, you know, I know 2022, when generative AI first came out, you know, 21, I was like, if you're doing mergers and acquisitions, you don't want your stuff running on a public instance in a public cloud. You want your stuff in a secret squirrel location. And I could foresee that people would want their own private custom models with all their proprietary stuff in that.
You're ahead of the curve, Kate, because that was actually our second use case that we ever had from one of Australia's largest legal firms. Was actually looking at due diligence and discovery and being able to look at the cost mechanics behind it and the efficacy of generative AI relative to what was possible for the amounts of money.
Yeah, that's so important because I've seen – I was used to work for two really big insurers, one after the other, and one of them tried to take the other one over and they didn't do proper due diligence. Oh. And it caused a very big hole in the balance sheet.
Wow. Well, look, I think that's one of the fantastic things about generative AI nowadays is the auditability that you're able to be able to get as well.
Tell me about that, because that's one of the things that I'm trying to work out. How can you audit something like that?
Okay, so there's a few things that you can do. So one is that you've obviously got a user prompt, which is, you know, so someone puts in their prompt, they'll get a response back from their model. When you hit an embedder to be able to actually source information or to hit any point of information, what we try and do is correspond that to back to the original answer and then try and...
So do you track provenance of every query, basically?
Correct. And right. We try and provide that to users as well. We feel it's very important. And particularly to your point in the legal profession, it's where that initially came up, where they said, okay, this is a great answer. How do we know it's okay? And so then we had to do that provenance to your point, where we had to go back and say the model used... this specific documentation in this sequence, and this is what it saw as the most important, this was the least important, this is how it went in, and this is what was generated as a function of that.
That's really great, because I was talking to my class saying, you know, with these, because increasingly, you know, people are going to be buying software as a service models, and if you don't contractually get obligations on them to make them auditable, they won't. They may not track the provenance of every transaction and stuff like that. So it can become really problematic to actually validate.
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting set of use cases you're talking to. And I had a conversation earlier this week talking to a chap who was more involved in blockchain, but he was interested in provenance from that perspective, i.e. how could AI tie up with the blockchain in a private distributed ledger to then be able to track provenance in real time.
I may have a solution for that.
Well, look, I'll certainly put you in touch, Kate, so very happy to do so.
You know, Opperman and I are working on something on the side in blockchain. It was really funny because in this class last week there were a number of very large banks. And, you know, they were talking about the problems of, well, how do we audit these technologies and how do we know that for a given input, the given output is accurate? And I said, well, we're going to have to work out how to be able to test these. And we're going to have to work out how we test them on software that we may not own.
I mean, Kate, this is the most fundamental thing in cutting edge technologies. And you're really, really, again, talking to the cutting edge as to how you can assess that you're doing things properly, that you're getting the right answers, that your model is doing exactly what you expect it to do. Anthropic actually released a really interesting paper. A guy that I actually grew up with, I'm a big fan of, Sholto Douglas, who came from Google DeepMind and is now over at Anthropic. He was discussing something along the lines of that they were playing with token samplers. They were suppressing some tokens. They were replaying them and putting in deterministic seeds as a starting point, so that they would be able to try and recreate and reproduce very, very specific model behavior. So I guess where I'm going with this isn't that everyone in the audience needs to understand, you know, the mechanics of what Anthropic have done, but it's more so that finally it feels like there's a bit more understanding as to how the, you know, an LLM properly formulates its responses now. And you can see it tracked. You can see them change certain things and say, you know, on the basis that we suppress these tokens, what happens to the sequence vectors? You know, really interesting stuff, Kate. I really recommend it for everybody.
All right. Well, we'll grab that and put that in the show notes for everybody. I want to read it.
Absolutely. So just wait until the end and I'll really happily put that on there.
Yeah. It's really interesting because all the banks were like, we love the idea of AI, and they were mainly talking about generative AI. And then I explained what agentic AI is, and everybody was like, we're not interested in generative AI anymore. We're really interested in agentic AI. Can you explain it to us? And I'm like, it didn't exist this time last year. It's still quite new.
Yeah, we keep hearing that as well. I mean, people think a little bit that it's more a panacea for everything, which it could end up being closer to something like that. But it's still, you know, for enterprise use cases, Kate, it's obviously very different than, you know, for your average retail user that just wants to be impressed and have a very good, cool experience. You know, for enterprise, it really has to be, to your point, accurate. It has to be on point, and the company has to be able to do some kind of validation.
Yeah. Well, you just think about the banks. You know, I used to manage a call center back in the day for a bank, and customers used to answer shop. So they'd phone and they'd get an answer they didn't like, and then they'd phone back and try another person. And, you know, that would always cause us problems, and you don't want that. And the point of AI should be that you can get the same answer for the same question to the right person every time.
Yeah. But you are, again, a great point, because people are shopping nowadays. If it's not OpenAI, it's Anthropic. If it's not Anthropic, it's Gemini 2.5 Pro. If it's not them, it's DeepSeek R1 and hopefully R2. And then obviously Llama 4 just came out. So, you know, I guess everyone is looking for that. And, you know, I guess that's what you see on YouTube every 5 minutes is the latest review of the latest model and why it's the best. And, you know, it's enough to make your head spin right now.
Well, I stopped watching those because it's just another variation on a theme. They're all going to be getting better. But what I do is I basically use one for a week and then I move to the next one just so I get a feel for how it's working at the time.
And how it's performing. I mean, how do you find that nowadays? So what do you think, for example, have you tried out Llama 4 yet?
No.
Okay.
I've got around to that. I'm on Perplexity this week.
Oh, that very nice. So they're people who can organize data really well. So in terms of being able to push it, as we said, to the right pipeline to try and finesse how you'll get a good response. So, I mean, it's just amazing how many different directions people are looking at right now. So, I mean, getting more into the technology side, Kate, some of the other stuff that interests us majorly just on that thematic of, you know, the future being small is quantization.
And
look, there was a fork in the road about 2 years ago when we had tried to understand where we were going to be in the AI space. And I met a group out of the US who had been operating for a while, and they were previously data scientists, probably the equivalent of CSIRO here.
Mm-hmm.
And
which probably doesn't exist now in America.
No, it probably doesn't. So they're a dying species. But to that end, she was able to demonstrate to me that with a tiny amount of examples and a lot of diversity, she was able to train really tiny nothing models to do something interesting at the time. Anyway, her company went on to become a billion-dollar company. It's called mm-hmm. LA Mini, and it's based out of San Fran, and they are phenomenal at what they do. And so my point being that I was at the very beginning, I looked at their technology and I said, wow, that is so much better than what we can do. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point that I said, inference is for us. No one's cracked that yet. And quantization was the first thing that we actually hit, mm-hmm. which was to be able to take a model, to be able to reduce the form of the weights, and then to be able to instantiate that smaller model either using a linear or non-linear technique, and then to be able to run that model just as you would any other model in, you know, transformers or, you know, a VLLM-like approach, to be able to then scale that model en masse for customers. And, you know, we actually got really, really far. So from our perspective, we consider ourselves to be very, very proficient at quantization, to the extent that, you know, we recognize in the US people like to use FP16 as they can have the most certainty that it's good. A lot of other people are, you know, I would say secondarily, people are using FP8 and INT4, you know, different floating point units for how they hold a model together. And from our standpoint, we've actually migrated towards INT3 for our production model. So we're using 3-bit quantization, which we consider to be world leading, even though it's not the smallest that exists.
So what drove that thinking?
The same thinking that you had, that the future was small, that we needed to be able to run things on small devices. We wanted a future for our users that was autonomous. And we felt that the only way to do that was to be able to bring the models and all the infrastructure to a customer site.
Which is, you know, my future on a small device like this.
Absolutely. I mean, on anything, really.
Well, this leads me to the other. We were chatting before we started the podcast about some sovereign risks that have emerged recently, and I was saying that I've been telling people, anybody who doesn't have sovereign data risk with public clouds, American-based public clouds, now is wrong and stupid. And so I'm thinking that a lot of people that are doing AI will, with secret stuff that they need, they want to make sure is not at risk, are really going to want to bring that home or put it into a safer jurisdiction, where one person can't cut it off.
Absolutely. Look, I think what we're seeing around the market is a repatriation, if you'd like, that's somewhat due to geopolitical events, somewhat due to a little bit of a fear of AI. And I think a large part of it's also coming from quantum computing as well.
Unpack that for me.
Okay. So look, some of the most recent advancements, primarily coming out of Asia, a firm called D-Wave in October 2024, they actually released something that was pretty interesting at the time, which was they had alleged that they had been able to crack an RSA key.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Which is pretty noteworthy. And, you know, look, even though that was also, to be fair, possible to be done by a supercomputer that exists right now, it was more so how quickly they were advancing to then, you know, on the basis that they had more qubits, then it seemed likely that they would be able to go for something significantly more, you know, important, let's say, to our infrastructure. And we think as a result, we think that there is a lightning pace in quantum computing that is happening in parallel to AI. And in some respects, it's feeding off each other a little bit. In terms of, you know, for quantum, the largest problems that they have are around entanglement, which is the way that they're able to keep quantum computing stable. And AI is able to significantly help with that much, you know, a reasoning model by definition is able to help. In that context. So
maybe if you could unpack that a bit for the audience, because I don't think most people will understand it, because that's a really important, the interplay between them is really interesting and important.
It really is. So from the perspective of how quickly AI has actually evolved, particularly over the last 2 years, I think most people are blown away. Genuinely, even the people at the very forefront, you know, you hear Mr. LaCoya, you hear Mr. Hinton, you know, people who were really the pioneers in the space, they're blown over going, wow, this is a lot faster and more evolved than we ever thought possible in such a short time frame. So what we understand is that technically speaking, we're speeding up and it feels like that. As opposed to slowing down, it seems to be getting faster and faster. And so as a result, the ability to be able to comprehend really complex analytical data that's required for things like quantum computing hasn't really been possible and very beneficial until, let's say, a year ago, maybe the advent of GPT-4. And then ever since then, it's been game on for AI to really work on advancing quantum computing. And what we're seeing is breakthroughs all across the board. So Ionic, D-Wave, Microsoft have some very, very big claims. I guess the thing is, if only a third of those things are true,
that's still a lot.
It's unbelievable.
Lot. Yeah.
I don't know. It's almost like the Industrial Revolution in multiple dimensions going on all at once. So all we see is that getting faster and faster. What does it look like exactly, Kate? Not, I can't tell you.
Who knows?
Exactly. But yeah. But we definitely know that AI is helping, and we know that it's helping with a very certain problem, which is a fundamental one to quantum computing, which is entanglement.
Well, it just seems to me that NIST was the very prescient when they released their quantum safe cryptography a couple of years ago.
Well, look, I've always been a little bit skeptical that you could actually, I mean, that's why everyone's trying to come out with genuinely random ciphers. And I think, you know, people like JP Morgan have built their own quantum computers to try and generate a truly random key. I'm still a little bit apprehensive because as these things get more and more powerful, it's unknown what their capabilities really look like.
Yeah.
But
I think the important thing was that it got it onto the cybersecurity world's radar that they needed to be thinking about cybersecurity from a different perspective.
Absolutely.
To be quantum safe, and that was the value of that. I think it was a really interesting. They had their little prize, and they selected a number of encryption methods. So, you know, it was really a really valuable sort of project, I think. But does NIST even still exist? Who knows in Trump land?
Unclear. But there have been some really interesting experiments. I've heard of some communications devices using quantum computing that are allegedly a lot more secure than pre-existing networks and, you know, for example, satellite technology that's certainly being worked on. So there's small use cases that we're seeing for right now, particularly in the sovereign data space.
Mm. Well, the sovereign data space is about to get a lot more important, I think. So what are you seeing as what are your big bets for the future? There's quantum, there's AI, but what things are you thinking will happen in the medium term?
Okay, well, in the medium
term. And for me, the medium term is like 2 years.
Well, absolutely, because nowadays it seems like a day is a week is a month is a year in AI terms. So
yeah.
Look, on that basis, we're talking to a 2 years is unfathomable.
Yeah.
So in the short term, I think energy requirements are going to drive somewhat the large scale people. So, for example, Grok, Gemini, Meta, you know, OpenAI, Anthropic. It does feel, to the point that we were making before, that there's very small incremental gains between them all, but that come at a huge computational and electricity cost.
Yeah.
And just the economies of scale. So even in the most cynical of economic ways of looking at that, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So perhaps what we'll see is consolidation in the space quite a lot more, and people teaming up. And as people get larger and larger, you know, it seems more feasible that one company might get access to a nuclear power station, but I'm not sure whether everyone would get access to atomic power to be able to power the forward-looking training.
This is a subtle reference to Microsoft having rebooted a nuclear power station in the US to fuel their AI empire desires. But one of the interesting things, I was out at the Australian Computer Society the other night, and they were doing a session on data centres in Australia. And one of the big roadblocks to expansion of data centres in the country is actually personnel to staff them.
Wow.
And the industry were there saying, yeah, if you could talk to kids and tell them it's a good career and stuff, like kids don't know it's a good career and they should. So it's one of the interesting limiting factors, because we've got all of this growth happening with AI and quantum, but the places where we house them, we need people who know how to look after them. And we still need people. Yeah. It's funny.
I mean, that's why we have to cultivate, and that's why we're doing these podcasts, I guess, Kate, is that what we want is a brighter future for AI, and we want Australia to be at the forefront of that as well.
Yeah, we do. And that's probably a pretty good time to call this done. So thanks very much, Gerard. Lovely to chat to you.
Always. Thank you very much, Kate. It's really been a pleasure. You take care.
Great.